right, well, thanks very much for the organizers for putting this together. I like the format. Clearly, there are kinks to be worked out, but it's a lot of effort on the organizers' part, and I really appreciate it. Yeah, so this is joint work with Matthias Kreck and Peter Teichner. The main result is already on the board. Invertible topological field theories are SKK manifold invariants, but I suppose I should explain what exactly I mean by these things. So let me start off with a side that you might be more familiar with, like what are topological field theories? I assume you know that, but let me just sort of go through it so that I set up my notation for that and that we get the same language. So d-dimensional topological field theory from the point of view that Etienne Siegel sort of started up is a functor, symmetric monoidal functor, symmetric monoidal functor from suitable Bordism category. And I'll do little decorations in a minute. For now, I just want to decorate it with a dimension of the Bordisms, that's D, into a suitable target category. And the most physical target category would be vector spaces, or maybe better, graded vector spaces or super vector spaces. So let me just sort of spell out roughly what this means. So the objects in this Bordism category are closed manifolds of dimension d minus 1. Typically write y for such a thing. These are the objects in my Bordism category. And I associate to that a vector space f of y. More precisely, that's a super vector space, meaning it's z2 graded. And then the homomorphisms is this board okay, or should I use, and then I can. There's no rope for that one, though. Somebody taller, maybe, than me? Perfect, thank you. So the morphisms are Bordisms. So let me just draw a picture. So if I have objects y1 and y0, then a Bordism, which I denote by sigma, will be a manifold with boundary. Say if y0 looks like that, y1 looks like that, it's a manifold whose boundary is the disjoint union of these things. And yeah, I'll associate to that then a linear map E of this Bordism from the vector space E of y0 to E of y1. And the most important part is that the symmetric monoidal piece, that is saying that on the left-hand side, you can take disjoint union of either your objects or your Bordisms, and that should correspond to the tensor product of the corresponding objects on the right-hand side. So on the left-hand side, you have disjoint union. And on the right-hand side, that should correspond by this functor to the tensor product on the right-hand side. Now, I want to be a little bit more precise. We're interested in manifold equipped with a suitable tangential structure. So that could be an orientation or a spin structure. And more generally, I will be starting with the following data. Suppose that you have a d-dimensional vector bundle over some topological space X. Then, what's that? Very good. So then I want to define what I mean by excise structure. Excise structure on such a d-dimensional manifold will be that I have a d-dimensional manifold equipped with a map to X in such a way. Together with a map of the tangent bundle of sigma that covers it. So I control the tangent bundle of sigma via a pullback of this, this d-dimensional vector bundle. Correspondingly for these y's, in which case, of course, if I pull this bundle back, I get a d-dimensional bundle, and I want an isomorphism between that and the tangent bundle of y together with the trivial line bundle. Okay, so this is, that's the things I really want to talk about. So let me then smuggle in the notation here. So I write Bort upper xi for that, and then the objects are closed in minus one manifolds with structure. You're audible too. You're audible too, Matthias. All right, so we have xi structures on our Bortisms as well as on our manifolds. So the xi structures on this closed d minus one manifolds as well as the xi structures equipped.
Can we cut them off? I mean, is it?
Yes, we're working on it, yeah.
Xi structures. The other thing that I should say, so these are the morphisms. Well, I was cheating slightly, since suppose that you have a manifold, another Bortism sigma prime, which is isomorphic, which is diffeomorphic to sigma relative to the boundary, meaning I have the identity near the boundary, and these xi structures fit together. So the morphisms are really Bortisms modulo diffeomorphisms, psi diffeomorphisms relative boundary. Does that make sense? So yeah, I want to identify things if I have a diffeomorphism preserving the xi structure between them. So these are field theories. So let me introduce the following notation. So I write topological field theory with the subscript d to indicate the dimension and the superscript xi to indicate the tangential structure that I'm interested in. So these are field theories, topological field theories. On xi manifold. More precisely, well, a field theory is a functor. Now, suppose you have two functors and you have a natural isomorphism between them, then you want to consider them as equivalent. And this is my notation for equivalence classes of such things. Modular equivalence. Okay. So now what does it mean? Yes?
What is the x? I miss what the x was in that diagram.
The x typically could be something like the classifying space of spin n or spin d, but it could also be a space cross spin d. So it's a pretty flexible notion. So now I need to say, well, what I mean by invertible. So, definition. So, invertible field theory is, well, what you require something for this functor, namely, you require two things. One is that the image is not an arbitrary vector space, but rather it's invertible vector space, invertible with respect to the tensor product. So it needs to be a line. The other requirement is, to each d-dimensional bordism, you associate a linear map. That map is supposed to be invertible. So that's the invertibility refers to both of those things. A nice way to combine both of these things is to say, oh, so an invertible field theory is just a symmetric monoidal functor from this bordism category into the subcategory of S-vect, where you have this invertibility, and that subcategory is a category of lines. So this S-line, so this is the subcategory of superlines. And invertible linear maps. So I want to make some general remarks. This one here and this one here is a symmetric monoidal category, but if you have this additional properties, that means that the spectrum that you can associate to that, if you, blah, 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 how do I say it? So you can pass to classifying spaces, right? The fact that these are symmetric monoidal category means that this classifying space actually is a zero space in a spectrum. So there's a spectrum associated to this and associated to that. Now, in general, the functors between them are not the same, induce a map between the corresponding classifying spectra, but in general, that's not the same classification. So they are sort of more equivalence classes of functors than there are homotopy classes of maps between the spectra. But if you restrict to these invertible field theories, that is no longer the case. And you have a one-to-one correspondence between these invertible field theories and your functors between your spectra. And that's great for homotopy theorists, right? That means, well, you can just sort of sit down and calculate, provided you understand the, well, what does the classifying spectrum of this bordism category look like? And that's important work by Mattson, or Galatius Mattson. Mattson, Tillman, and Weiss. So they identify the corresponding bordism spectrum . So that means you are off to the races and you can use all these sort of homotopy theoretic tools to calculate these things. This is not what I'm going to do in this talk. Our stuff is totally geodemetric. It does not use this result. So let me tell you about how we go about this. So the first thing we do is we look at the partition function of such a field theory. Let's see, I need more space for that. Let me pass to the next board. So what's the partition function of such a field theory F? Well, that means you evaluate on closed manifolds. Okay? So you have then a map that if you have a field theory F, you evaluate on closed manifolds. In other words, you look at the set of psi manifolds of closed psi manifolds, dimension D. And, well, this partition function will only depend on the psi diffeomorphism type, right? Since our morphisms are correspond to psi diffeomorphism type. So I mod out by psi diffeomorphisms. So then you can evaluate on such a sigma in here, your field theory, F of sigma. And you get a complex number, in fact, a non-zero complex number, since we're talking about an invertible field theory. So you get a map here. And this map is called, I call the partition function of this particular field theory, F, Z sub F. Okay. So now you might contemplate, well, what are the properties of this particular map here, right? So what are properties? Of this partition function. Well, there are two properties. One is, if you take the disjoint union of two such things, so let me just abbreviate that with Z. So if you take evaluate Z on the disjoint union of two manifolds, that is Z of sigma 1 times Z of sigma 2. This is just a property. You can think of this here as a composition of these two bordisms. And well, yeah, then that corresponds to the composition of these two morphisms, which in this case just happen to be numbers. Second property is more interesting. I don't need to draw a little picture. So suppose that you have a manifold Y. So that's a D minus 1 manifold. And suppose that you have a zero bordism for that. Well, let's call it, say, M1. And you have another zero bordism for it, which you think of as a bordism from Y to the empty set. Let's call it N1. Then you can glue them together and evaluate Z on this manifold. Now, suppose that you have two such things with the same D minus 1 manifold, but other zero bordisms, say M2 and N2. Then you could evaluate Z on the disjoint union of these two guys. Now, the property that this partition function has is it doesn't change if you replace if you swap the M1 for the M2. So put the M2 here and put the N1 here and glue that together with the M1 here and the N2 there. Claim is that does not change the value of the partition function. So we are not looking at all maps from closed manifolds into C cross. We are only looking at maps which satisfies property 1 and 2. And these is what I call SKK invariants. SKK invariants, or SKK manifold invariants. So they are have the specific property that, yeah, they are homomorphisms, good, but the more critical property is they don't change if you sort of cut along here and then glue it together. That's basically, that's where the name came from. So Matthias Kreck, whom you heard from recently, studied these groups in the early 70s and called them SKK groups, where this S stands for schneiden, which means cutting in German. The K stands for kleben, which is gluing. And the K stands for controlled. So not all kind of cutting and gluing is allowed, since if you allow all kinds of cutting and gluing, the only invariant that you will be left with is the Euler characteristic. That's too boring. So by putting in this control, by putting in this relation, you get something more interesting, okay? So let me restate this slightly. Another way of stating it is to say, well, let's give this set of closed Xi manifolds a name. Let's call this Xi man.
Maybe you said this and I just missed it, but this extra number two is because of invertibility.
Yes, and I'm going to do a remark on that. Let me just sort of write down, set up the notation, and I'll show you how that works. But yes, invertibility is absolutely crucial for that to be true. So let me denote, let me write xi man for this set, but notice it's a monoid, right? So this here is a monoid with the structure given by disjoint union of these things. So then I can say, oh, then I might as well group complete this monoid, right? So I take S man, I take C man, I take its group completion. So then I have a group, and I'm looking at homomorphisms from there into, oh no, and then I want to put in this relation. I want to say, oh, whenever I have a picture like that, right? This is a particular object in this group here. This is a particular other object in this group. And yeah, whenever I get two pictures in the way I described, I want to identify those two. I look at the quotient of this group where I identify this manifold with that manifold. This one here is called SKK of dimension D with tangential structure Xi. So that's the group that you get by imposing this Schneiden and Kleben relation. And so then another way of writing this down is, well, this one here is then just homomorphisms from this group SKK into C cross. Okay. So now I want to go to David's question and show you why is it true that for invertible field theories, you have this SKK invariance of your partition function. To write this down, it helps to write this picture here, this last picture, in a slightly different way. Give you a little bit of space here. I'm going to write it like this. So it starts off looking like the first picture. I have the M1 up here. I have the M2 up here. And at the bottom, I have, as in both pictures, the N1 and the N2. But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, oh, in this picture here, I need to glue this with that. One way of doing this is I can say, okay, I sort of put in a cylinder here, and I put a cylinder in here, right? That's the same picture. So in other words, I'm saying when you take the original picture versus if you stick in this sort of switching thing in the middle, it doesn't make a difference, right? So why should the switching thing not make a difference? So let's look at the corresponding functor applied to this thing here. So this thing I think of as a Bordism from the empty set to two copies of Y. Then I do the switcheroo, which I call sigma. That's sort of, technically speaking, the Brady isomorphism in the symmetric monoidal Bordism category, going back to YY. Y disjoint union Y, and going back to the empty set, right? That's what's happening. So now I apply my functor F. What happens? Well, the empty set is a monoidal unit, so I get C here. Here, I get the morphism associated to F applied to M1. Tensor, the morphism associated to M2. Going into the vector space associated to Y, tensor itself. And here comes the algebraic braiding isomorphism, right? From F of Y into F of Y tensor Y. And then I apply F of N1 tensor F of N2 to go back to C. That's the algebraic picture. So the big question is, well, why should that not make a difference, right? That's what the relation says. It doesn't make a difference whether I have this middle piece here or the identity. Now, what is this map? If I weak tensor W, well, that goes to W tensor V, but I need to be careful. I'm thinking in the graded world, so it depends on the grading of these things. So there's a factor of -1, the degree of W times the degree of V in there. So sometimes this is not the identity. If it were not the identity, so I'm talking about lines here, right? For lines, the basis vector is given by V tensor V, and so the only thing that comes in is possibly the sign. So why don't I get the sign? Well, the sign depends on whether the f of y is an even or odd line. Why does it have to be an even line? Well, I'm assuming that the y is zero Bordon. But then the y, this zero Bordenism M1, gives me an isomorphism between the trivial line and the line for y. So y must be an even line. Okay? So that's why this Schneiden and Kleben has to be done in a controlled way. For example, what would not be true, I could have a more general thing. I could have a zero Bordenism from the empty set into y disjoint union y. Sort of like, yeah, sort of wormhole over here, right? Then this argument of saying, oh, the line associated to y must be an even line wouldn't work, and then this thing is wrong. So it's subtle, so you need to be careful what kind of Schneiden and Kleben you allow, and that's sort of specified by these pictures. Any questions? Yeah.
Maybe I'll say this later, but is somehow, so if you're going to say that the invertible field theories are SKK manifold invariants, mm-hmm. it does matter that the target is super bound.
Yeah, it does make a difference in general, right?
Is that going to be... Is there a reason?
I mean, to me, supervector is the most desirable target from a physics point of view. So that's why I stuck in the most desirable target. And you could run the same story with just lines, and you get slightly different answers. Any other questions?
Sorry, could you also just say what question you're answering?
I'm sorry. Yes. So the question was, why do I look at superlines as target? Why not just as lines? And how does it influence a story? And yeah, either one can be analyzed by this. All right, so now I've set up the basic language. Now I can write down the precise statement of the result. Oops. Okay, so here's the theorem. So I look at TFTs of dimension D with a Xi structure, and I want to indicate by this letter that I'm talking about invertible field theories. And then, yeah, we saw by this construction here, the partition function gives us a map to the homomorphisms of the SKK group into C cross. And the statement is, as the title of the talk says, that's an isomorphism. So that says, well, if you understand the group SKK, you understand everything about these invertible field theories. So to me, it's so fascinating that these sort of objects that were considered in the beginning of the 70s then sort of turn out to be, oh, these are really important things if you want to understand invertible field theories, which I understand might be interesting to physicists for condensed matter purposes or whatever. I don't know much about these things. So what do we know about these SKK groups? Well, what you might try to say is, you say, okay, well, SKK is closed psi manifolds of dimension D, what is some equivalence relation, namely this sort of cutting and pasting stuff. Well, there's another equivalence relation we can think of, namely Bordism, right? And yeah, you fiddle with that and you see, Bordism is sort of a much more sort of rigorous equivalence relation. No, sorry. So you have a map, obviously, from SKK d xi into omega d xi. So it's a Bordism group of psi manifolds of dimension D. So in other words, there you're identifying two psi manifolds whenever you find a zero a Bordism between them. Now I said, well, obviously you have such a map. No, this is not obvious. Think about it. So this psi structure is a structure that is a good thing for manifolds of dimension D, since you're pulling back this D-dimensional vector bundle psi, and then you're saying, oh, I want an isomorphism between that and the tangent bundle. But if you have a zero Bordism here, it's going to be D plus one dimensional, right? So these psi structure, they don't play well with sort of D plus one dimensional manifolds. So I want to make an assumption here. Put an assumption. So if, say, our psi structure is a spin structure, then of course we have no difficulties talking about a spin structure of a vector bundle one dimension higher. So now I want to say for a general psi structure, what does it mean to be able to talk about sort of an analogous psi structure one dimension higher? And that's the following, but that's an assumption on psi, and it's the following thing. I want to find an x prime and a psi prime. This here is of dimension d plus 1. When I have that, then I can look at this sphere bundle. And I imagine I have a metric on this bundle so that I can work with this sphere bundle of this thing. And this, my requirement is that my original x that I thought of should be identifiable with a sphere bundle of that psi prime. And if you think about it in the case where x is, say, b spin d, then the x prime would be the b spin d plus 1. So this is sort of what you're used to in the standard cases. And over the x, I have the psi. And how is that related to this one here? Well, if I add a trivial line bundle and pull back via this projection map here, then I have an isomorphism here. So I need to be able to sort of stabilize my psi structure. Question?
Sorry, I lost track of the logic of that board. Is that an assumption for the theorem or only for the kind of comments?
No. So I'm done with the theorem. Now I want to develop, well, what do we know about the SKK groups? I'm going to write down a proposition in a minute, but I need to set up the notation for it. So this is going to be assumption for the proposition that I'm going to write now down. Sorry, it was here. I have this map. So now I can put the psi prime there, and this makes perfect sense. And the statement is, first, well, it's surjective. Secondly, I have a map into this one here from the integers, which is given by sending 1 to the class represented by the D-sphere. And the statement is, this is exact sequence. I didn't say it's short exact, so I'm not saying the map phi here is injective. That's going to be the second part of this proposition. And so, and it's good to discuss that depending on the parity of the dimension D. So if D is even, then phi is injective. And that's easy to see, since, well, if you have the Euler characteristic, which has all the cutting and gluing properties that you like, so this is a homomorphism out of this SKK group, and clearly then in D ought, the Euler characteristic of the D sphere is 2, so yeah, this is an injection then, right? So what happens? But I should say it's not split in general, right? Since there might be manifolds that have Euler characteristic 1, which means, well, you can't have a split homomorphism back. But whether you have a closed manifold of dimension D with excise structure without Euler characteristic does depend on this Bordism group, right? The Bordism group, depends on whether you find a manifold. Whether the Euler characteristic in here is sometimes odd. So what happens if D is odd? Well, then the class represented by the D sphere is just a 2 torsion class. So 2 times this class must be 0. So the only question is, well, okay, when is it 0? When is it non-zero? How do I calculate that? And this statement is, this here is non-zero precisely if, let's see, they exist. Let's see, how do I want to say that? Let me double check. This is the closed. Prime manifold W with Euler characteristic odd. Is equal to 0. Yeah, let me just fix this for a second. Question?
Yeah, I have a question. You write SD, the d-dimensional sphere, and this somehow assumes that there is a canonical psi structure on the sphere. Can you comment on that? What is the canonical psi structure?
Yes.
On the sphere?
So the way that I like to think of the d-sphere is I like to think of that as a double of the disk. So I think of the d-disk with sort of the canonical psi structure on it as a Bordism from the empty set to the D minus one thing, and then I glue in sort of another copy of the D disk as a Bordism going out. Okay. Does that answer the question, Andre?
No. I don't understand why that gluing should always be possible. I mean, but maybe it's
under you take the boundary of the plus one, plus we have to start time.
Ah, okay, because of this assumption. Okay.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
All right. So what I want to do now is I want to make some examples. Maybe first some comments here. So this proposition basically shows that the calculation of these SKK groups boils down to this calculation of these d-dimensional Bordism groups. Well, we have a big history in algebraic topology and tools like the atom spectral sequence that allow us to calculate those things. So I would claim that well, if D is, say, smaller than or equal to 20, that with enough sort of determination, you can calculate any of those things. So there's good tools out there. So this is stuff that is readily calculable. Not readily, but you can do it. There's a machine to do it. Okay, now I want to give you some. So obviously then, whenever you have a homomorphism from this D-dimensional Borism group, omega D, into C cross, well, then you get a field theory, right, according to this theorem. So you get plenty of that way. Let me give you examples of things that come from sort of the Z part, coming from the sphere. That would be examples. And let me just give you what the partition functions are. So first, if D is even, so then we have that this D sphere has is an infinite cyclic summand in SKK. And you have the Euler correctors. There's a homomorphism out of SKK. So in particular, if you pick any number, any non-zero complex number, then you have a homomorphism from SKK psi into C cross, which is given by associating to a manifold sigma lambda to the power of the Euler characteristic of X of sigma. So those are the so-called Euler characteristic theories. Let me give you an example if D is odd. Of course, here to get something interesting, I should assume that I'm in a situation where the D sphere is non-trivial. That means I want to make sure that on all closed psi prime manifolds, the Euler characteristic is even. So let me do a specific example. Let me choose the psi to be the three-dimensional universal spin bundle. So the psi is a bundle over B spin 3. Okay, so then what do I know about the omega D? Well, so then the omega 3, say prime, that's usually called omega 3 spin. Well, that's trivial. On the other hand, I know that the Euler characteristic of a spin 4 manifold is always divisible by 2, which according to the statement of the proposition then says, oh, so the SKK group must be Z mod 2. So the SKK group here is dimension 3 is isomorphic to Z mod 2. And then you could ask, well, sort of how is that given explicitly? So if you have a spin 3 manifold, how do you associate to that an invariant in Z2? Well, that's the so-called semi-characteristic. So what you do is you take the zeroth cohomology of sigma, its coefficients in F2, and you take the dimension of that. And then you sort of, we are calculating mod 2, so it doesn't make a difference whether I write plus or minus here. So you write down something like the Euler characteristic, which would be the alternating sum of it, but you stop after about the middle. That's why it's called the semi-characteristic. And this is the invariant that determines this SKK. So that gives you fun examples of field theories. All right, now in the last part, I want to give you an idea of sort of how this theorem is proven.
Is that second example specific to three dimensions, or you can do that?
You could do that in other dimensions as well. So this is more like, okay, well, the Borism part is zero, so it's easy to write down. So it only rests upon your ability to figure out, well, do you have manifolds where this thing is odd? So if you have some Borism groups where that is always even for whatever reason, then it works. So for example, like the oriented Bordism group.
Can you repeat the question?
I'm sorry. So was the dimension three specific here, or could you do analogous things in higher dimension? And the answer is no, you can do that in quite generality. It all rests on the ability to decide whether in this Bordism category you have things where the order characteristic has to be even. So for example, that example would not work if I have just oriented manifolds, since there are oriented four manifolds with order characteristic one, for example, the complex projective plane. All right, so let me give you the outline of the proof of this. So what's an invertible field theory? So by definition, that's a functor from this symmetric monoidal Bordism category into the category of superlines. Now, this one here is a category which is called a Picard category, or Picard groupoid maybe better. Let me write down what this means. On definition. So symmetric monoidal category is a Picard groupoid. If, well, first of all, it needs to be a groupoid, so yeah, every morphism. Is invertible. But secondly, you want that every object is invertible. And on objects, you have the tensor product. So you want an inverse with respect to the tensor product. And yeah, that's a sort of obviously the case of in S line by definition of that thing. Now, whenever you have a functor from a symmetric monoidal category into a Picard groupoid, then this automatically factors through the Picard groupoid that you can manufacture from that by inverting the morphisms. So let me write this for the Bordism category with all morphisms inverted. You might say, oh, but okay, I can invert all the morphisms in my Bordism category, but don't I also need to take care of that the lines are invertible? Turns out, no, that's automatic. You always have, say, if have a it's always the case. So this one here is also a Picard category, Picard groupoid. Now, functors between Picard groupoids is something which is easy to understand. And that's quite an old theorem. Goes back to a student of Grothendieck in 75. So let me outline the statements. So let's say B is a Picard groupoid. Then what are the important invariants that you can associate to B? Well, you can, for example, look at the isomorphism class of objects in this Picard groupoid. Let me write pi naught of this one here. Let's see the objects up to isomorphism. And well, that's an abelian group, right? With the tensor product giving you the group structure. Let me just call B0 of these things, short notation. You have another abelian group that you could look at. Namely, you could look at the automorphism group of the monoidal unit. And that might not look like an abelian group at first glance, but it in fact is, since instead of composing, you can tensor those things together, and that gives you obviously an abelian structure. Okay, what other information do you have? Well, there's also a funny homomorphism called the Kane variant, which is a homomorphism from B0 into the two torsion of B1. How does that work? Well, suppose that you take an object, Y here. I'd represent an element in B0. Then you can look at the so-called braiding isomorphism, right? You can form Y tensor Y, and then you have this braiding isomorphism that swaps the two copies of Y. That's not in general the identity, but it is an element in the automorphism of Y tensor Y. And in fact, it's a two-torsion element, since symmetric monoidal says, well, if you do it again, this braiding, you get the identity, right? So it's a two-torsion in this group. Oh, but in a Picard category, the automorphism group of any object is canonically isomorphic to the automorphism group of the monoidal unit, or just tensoring with the identity on that object. So that's the same thing as the two-torsion in the automorphism group of the monoidal unit, which is that. So this one here is called the Kane variant. The reason for that is, if you pass from these things to the classifying spectra, then these spectras have only homotopy groups in dimension 0, namely that, homotopy groups in dimension 1, namely that, and this is in fact the Kane variant in the topology's sense. All right, and so then this theorem due to Sin in 75 is that up to equivalence, the B is determined by this triple, by knowing pi naught and pi 1 and the Kane variant of this Picard group point. And this is, in fact, a one-to-one classification. If you give me any triple, there's also a corresponding Picard category. The first statement. Well, the second thing you want to understand is, well, you want to understand how about functors, right? That's what we're looking for. We're looking for functors between Picard group points. What are they? So here I want to look at the functors from a Picard group point B to Picard group point D, and I want to look at them up to equivalence, up to natural equivalence. Well, if you have such a functor, F, you can obviously sort of get induced maps on pi naught, pi one, right? So you have, could look at maps F naught from B zero to C0 and induce map on pi 1, which goes from B1 to C1. Now the question is any such pair of homomorphisms realized by a functor of Picard groupoids? And the answer is no. It needs to be a compatibility relation that says, well, the Kane variants of these two Picard groupoids talk to each other. And that's expressed in the following way. So start with the Kane variant of, say, your domain category. That's a homomorphism from B0 to B1. Well, then you can postcompose with F1 to get a homomorphism from B0 to C1. And that should be equal to, let me take the k invariant of C and precompose with F0. So this is a compatibility condition. And statement is, hey, then this map becomes surjective. Every such pair of maps, which is compatible with the k-invariance, is in fact realized by a functor between these Picard groupoids. However, this is not an injective map. In general, you have a kernel, but the kernel is easy. It's just an X group. It's X1 of the abelian group B0, comma C1. And the statement is, this is an exact sequence of abelian group. All right, so now let's look at the cases we're interested in. So we're interested in pi naught and pi one, and the k invariant of the following categories. So first, let's look at S line. Up to isomorphism, there are two objects, right? The two even lines and odd lines. So this group is Z2. The outer morphisms of the line of is C cross. And then you need to calculate the k-invariant, which is just a homomorphism from Z mod 2 into C cross. And hey, that turns to be out the unique non-trivial map. And that comes from, well, yeah, if you have a put a minus sign in, if you have odd lines in your permutation. That was it by definition of the k-invariant that says, oh, that's non-zero. What about the Bordism category? Or rather, the Bordism category after we Picardify it, right? So then what is pi naught of it? When are two objects in the Bordism category equivalent, are connected by Bordisms? Well, that's the definition of the Bordism group, omega d minus one. And what is pi one? Well, so the empty set is a monoidal unit. We're looking at closed d-manifolds. Okay, what is the relation? Well, you shouldn't be surprised, it's the SKK group, right? So this one here is SKK, sub D psi. And then you could ask, okay, what's the K invariant here? So the K invariant is a map from the D minus one Bordism group to the SKK group, and that's given by crossing with S1. And of course, you need to be careful. What do you mean by that? And what is the structure? So you need to take it the right way, and that's it, is it. All right, so then we can apply what we've learned there. So we're interested in invertible field theories. This, by definition, is the same thing as functors from this. Let me just write B for this thing and C for this thing. So just then functors from B into C. And then we have our nice map here. So here, according to the general theorem, we have these compatible morphisms, right? So here we have, on one hand, the map F1, which goes from B1 into C1. Well, B1, that's the SKK group. Into C cross, and F0, that's the Bordism group in dimension D minus one, going into C mod two. And we need a compatibility relation here. But we said that this map here, the K invariant on the target, that's the inclusion map. Well, that means that this map is totally determined by first going up here via the k-invariant of the domain and then going over here. So this map is determined by this condition. So this one here is the same thing as just homomorphisms from SKK Psi D into C cross. What about the domain here? Well, the domain, according to the general theorem, is x1 of b0 c1, but c1 is c cross. Well, c cross is divisible. For any divisible group, the x groups are zero. Okay, so you get that this is an isomorphism. Thank you.
Start with questions on the other side.
Very good, very good. Thank you, Stefan. Are there any questions from this audience or Stefan's thoughts? Yes?
So if you, I guess this goes back to Eugene's question, if you had just taken lines instead of superlines, what does the statement of the theorem look like?
Sorry, could one of you repeat the question?
If you just use lines, isn't it superlines?
Okay, how would the theorem change? Well, actually, there's not that much change. So if I look at the situation here, in the presence of just lines, the pi naught of the target category would be zero. So this is zero. So in other words, yeah, we still have just homomorphism from the SKK group into C cross. So in a way, the statement of the end result does not really depend on that. It's just that from my perspective, the superlines are more interesting than the regular lines. And it's a more intricate story, since I needed to argue. But this part of the data is determined by that part of the data. And so I thought, oh, I should tell the more interesting story.
But the homomorphism across the circle has to vanish on your prediction. So it's not
Was that a question?
I think that was Peter Kahn.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure that this was said loudly enough so that other people could hear.
I'm just saying if you don't have super lines, you have a condition from the K-invariant, which says that if you go from omega d minus 1 psi up, the SKK by crossing the circle, and then the partition function that has to be zero.
Questions? We pass the microphone to the other audience.
Okay, are there questions on this side? Eugene?
Is there a way that you could have seen just by the heuristically from the definition of SKK invariants that it would have to be these kinds of invertible TFTs with target S line?
Could you repeat your question? I'm not sure.
Are you asking whether S line is somehow inevitable if you start with SKK invariants?
Yeah, like how could you know that, how could you know if at all that S line was the right target for S if you wanted to, if just by understanding, just by knowing the definition of SKK invariants?
So the question was, well, just knowing the definition of SKK invariants, how do you know that S line is sort of the correct target to work with? Well, that's the way I would look at it is, this is a story that would work for any target. So take your favorite Picard category as target and consider symmetric monodal functor into that Picard category. Then you can do the same analysis and writing down the sort of pairs of homomorphisms, and you just need to, that involve then homomorphisms from the SKK group into pi 1 of your favorite Picard category and maps from the Bodism group into your pi 0 of your favorite Picard category. And then you need to figure out what are the X groups. And no, you can run the same thing for any Picard category target. I just thought I'd concentrate on one rather than trying to tell a general story. And of course, I'm attracted to the fact that in this case, the story is has a sort of neat answer.
So does this approach generalize to maybe once extended invertible TQFTs and Picard two groupoids?
That's a very good question. So the question was, well, does this approach extend to, they say, one more extended field theories? So then you would look at Picard two group whites or so. I don't know an analogous statement that would be sort of generalizing Singh's result for Picard categories. I imagine that in analogy with sort of topology, then you have to control these three homotopy groups and you need to control sort of the K invariants that go with it. But I have no idea to what extent that's a manageable thing. So from my point of view is, well, you know, if you're interested in the extended stuff, then probably the homotopy theoretic approach to saying, hey, but we know even in the extended sense, this Bohrism, for the extended Bohrism category, we really know what the classifying space of that symmetric monoidal category is, or the classifying spectrum of that. So that homotopy theoretic approach definitely has the edge there. So no, it's just sort of in the non-extended case that the existing technology allows you to do these things very easily.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions? All right, well, let's... Thanks.
Yes.
Oh.
Do you know if this psi structure cannot be stabilized as in the assumption in the proposition, how can you compute SKP groups somehow?
So the question is whether if I don't have this assumption that the psi structure comes from sort of a stable psi structure, can we still say something about the SKK groups? And no, I don't know anything about that, and I'd love to know.
Okay, well, let's thanks Stefan again.